This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
...in the context of past immigration law.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 31st, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today, Portland City Council held a meeting seeking public comment on a proposal to require that employers of five or more employees in the city of Portland give their staff paid sick leave. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Andrea Caruso with the Everyone Benefits Coalition about her view of the proposal.
What will happen if this ordinance gets passed?
Basically, Commissioner Fritz's proposal suggests that all of the people working within Portland should be able to accrue sick time through their jobs. For those people who are working with for employers who have more than five employees, they would accrue an hour for every 30 hours they work, up to 40 hours over the course of a year, so basically 5 days if you're taking a full day, and that time should be paid at your regular salary or wage. For those folks working for businesses or employers with fewer than five or fewer employees, they would also accrue an hour for every 30 hours worked, up to 40 hours per year. That time would be unpaid but job protected. So you could take the time without pay without worrying about being fired for being sick or needing to care for a sick child or a family member.
What are some of the professions that people are working in that are not able to take sick leave? I mean, are we talking about like restaurant workers, people that handle food? Are they coming to work sick?
That's what we're hearing. So widely, 41% of private sector workers in and around Portland don't have access to paid sick days. We know nationally that 8 out of 10 of our lowest wage workers don't have access to paid sick days on the job. So the folks who are least likely to go a day, to be able to go a day without pay, without risking being able to pay rent or other bills at the end of the month, those folks are least likely also to have access to paid sick time on the job. And industry-wise, you know, we're in Portland, we see 8 out of 10 food service workers don't have access to paid sick days. So it is restaurant workers, other food service workers, child care workers, home health care workers. A lot of folks who have direct and ongoing contact with the public are working sick when they don't have paid time off to be able to stay home.
And I guess for parents also, this is a big issue.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. We've talked to a number of teachers and principals and school staff throughout the city who've said, especially during this last winter with the flu epidemic we've seen and norovirus outbreaks sweeping the city, that they've had lots of kids showing up to school sick, that they've not been able to, they're not always able to call parents to have them come pick them up from their jobs. This is a bigger issue in schools that have high free and reduced lunch rates, where there's higher rates of poverty within the school. There are parents who feel like if they leave work to go pick up their sick kids, they may be penalized or fired or will have to obviously go without pay. So that means, you know, sick kids are going to school when they should really be home recovering at home.
Does it seem likely that the ordinance is going to pass?
I feel like we're in a good position that folks on the city council understand the need, but there's still a lot of work to do to get us to a vote and an adoption of a sick days policy for Portland. They will be suggesting at the hearing a process, which basically will include is soliciting some feedback from some of the employers and business associations and other folks in the city during the next couple of weeks, with the idea to have a second hearing on this at the end of February and a vote in early March.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrea Peluso, who is the executive director of Family Forward Oregon, that is calling for a paid sick leave policy here in the city of Portland. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Portland City Council meeting on the issue of paid sick leave was running right up to KBOO press time, but we can provide some updates. KBOO reporter Quinn Reed was on the scene and captured the voices of some people outside City Hall ahead of the meeting.
My name is Steve Hughes with the Oregon Working Families Party. The ability to take a day off from work if you're sick is a very important issue, and it's affecting 40% of workers in the city of Portland, 80% of service workers, and many of those people are women and people of color. This is a real issue that affects a lot of working people in the city. I think we've got a really good chance of it passing. I think the opposition to it has been largely blunted by the fact that there are businesses, local businesses, speaking out in favor of it, including some very well-known ones, Pine State Biscuits, Milagros Boutique, Hawthorne Auto Clinic. So there's been some visible business support. And then there's just a very strong coalition behind this. This is part of a national effort to achieve what is essentially a basic labor standard that over 145 countries in the world have already written nationally. So the United States is lagging far behind. I think everybody here in support of this ordinance is in full agreement that what really needs to pass is a statewide ordinance, but that the city of Portland can be a leader on this in helping push this debate forward in a way that inaction will not do.
Linda Parmer. I'm with local 555, the United Retail Clerks, or UFCW. I'm journeyman at the local, and even at journeyman, the pay is not incredible. And if you're sick, even one day, that's 20% of your paycheck for the week. So as a result, a lot of people come to work ill or take their children to daycare ill, if they can manage that. And we're working with the public, and a lot of our customers are elderly, and it just bothers you that you're exposing them to that. But it's that, or pay your bills, buy your groceries, or whatever. So,
Councilwoman Amanda Fritz spoke this afternoon in defense of her proposal to require Portland employers with five or more employees to provide paid sick leave.
145 of the 196 countries in the world provide paid earned sick time. So for those who have been asking why now, my question is, why has it taken us so long? Employees are the heart of a business, and it's important for both employers and employees that the workplace be a place where everybody is treated fairly and where there is mutual respect, both of employers for their employees, and also of employees doing a good job on recognizing that their work contributes to the success of the business. Earned sick leave recognizes that a healthier workplace is also a more productive one. Approximately 40% of employees in Portland currently lack even one day of paid sick time. That means that 60% already have paid sick time. So it's not a radical concept. It's something that we need to be talking about and providing for all. Workers who don't have protected sick leave are predominantly low-wage earners and people of color, and it's essential that we bring this right to a city that has made equity a cornerstone of its future planning.
Legislators, business owners, and citizens were present to provide public input on mandatory paid sick leave for Portland workers. Here are some of the voices of community members who testified at the meeting.
My name is Deborah Cafori, and I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner. One thing that you will hear, I'm sure, from folks today is that this should wait, that this is something that should be handled at the state level. And I'm sure my colleagues here from Salem can talk about that as well. But as a former state legislator, I will tell you that the state of Oregon does not always do things in the most expedient fashion. You have an opportunity today to do something remarkable, to actually take a stand that is going to be leading the path for the state to follow.
My name is Patria Ford, and I've been in administrative personnel for about 17 years. I've had the privilege of working for three businesses in the Portland and Vancouver areas as an administrative staff member. Of the three, two of those companies offered paid sick leave. Only one did not. I had heard awful stories from people who worked for companies that didn't pay for sick time off and how it created a burden on their financial life coupled by unnecessary stress. It wasn't until I worked for the third company that I learned just how devastating it would be, or just how devastating it was when you have to make the often dreadful decision to take a sick day, knowing that you won't be compensated for that time, even though you've devoted yourself to the company you work for. What was worse, it created an undue hardship on my family, not being able to meet my monthly financial obligations. Having to choose between bills to pay, which bills to take late fees on, or how much less I'd have to provide for my household essentials until the next pay period. Not only does this situation create a financial hardship, but it also shows a lack of value for employees. In some cases, it reduces employee morale because it leaves the open-ended question, does the company I work for really care about its employees? One thing I focus on when looking for a new job is whether or not the company provides sick leave. As a single parent and as a human being, I know that there will be a time when I need to take a sick day. And because I know firsthand how devastating it can be financially if you are not paid, I often look for companies that value their workforce. For me, one of the ways of determining that is if they offer sick leave. Despite any rebuttal, the bottom line is if an employer can afford to pay an individual for time on the job, they can afford to pay an employee that they value for time needed to recover from an illness or a sickness.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Yates. I'm the president of the Portland Spirit Dinner Boats, which is a locally family-owned, employee-owned business. I want to address that I'm very disappointed with the process related to this ordinance. This is a very ambitious ordinance that has significant impacts on business employees and our general business climate in our city. I find it very disheartening that such a large sweeping ordinance has not been subject to an extensive review and discussion by all interested parties. This ordinance injects the city of Portland into the very heart of the employee-employer relationship while creating large financial and managerial impacts. The raw economic numbers are not hard to compute, but lack of clear rules in the ordinance fails to address conflicts in relationship to current employment laws, and this ordinance should do a comprehensive look to see how we can eliminate conflicts with federal employment laws. It is naive to think that a 3.3% cost in labor can be absorbed by employers without ramifications. The lack of a credible process has failed to identify what trade-offs employers will make to pay for this expensive program.
Andrea Peluso with the Everyone Benefits Coalition told our newsroom it is uncertain whether or not the proposed changes will be approved. In fact, the council isn't even expected to take a vote today, but the city council will revisit this issue and should be voting on it in the month of March.
A former employee of Portland Public Schools has filed a lawsuit against the district, alleging that she was forced to resign because of the behavior of school officials. The employee, who was an occupational therapist working with disabled students, claims she was overworked and was told by school officials to only work with students whose parents seemed likely to file a lawsuit. She also says her job was threatened when she told administrators about a teacher screaming at a child with autism and about teachers leaving classrooms of special needs kids unattended.
A forum for discussion of the pros and cons of several coal shipping projects currently under consideration will take place at Concordia University tonight. Cable reporter Robin Ryan spoke with the organizer, Akash Singh, about what to expect from the meeting.
Akash, can you give us some information about tonight's forum and what the focus is?
Tonight's forum is essentially an educational forum, an outreach forum. We've took many steps to avoid bias on pro-coal or anti-coal. Essentially, the point of today is to take the issue of coal and to present both sides appropriately.
And can you tell us about the five active Northwest export projects and their potential impact on the area?
The pro-coal advocacy groups, their essential market point is jobs and the financial boost it will give to the local economy. People who are against coal, their market points are that coal is degrading to the environment and to people's health. In terms of the actual projects themselves, the basic level of information I can give you is that there will be Portland coal trains, which will increase coal traffic by 94%. Those are the statistics that we've been given. And other than that, there's not too detailed information because proposals are still out.
And what is the status of the coal export terminals? When will projects be finalized?
It is not in a finalization state yet. The debate is still going, hence the reason for us to actually bring the forum to light in the first place. It's still in the deliberation stage.
And what are the next steps for people who want to get involved and take action on this issue?
There will be a few groups there at the forum. They will have literature and contact numbers. If anyone wants to become an advocate, get involved. For example, if you feel that coal is a good thing, there will be information from Alliance with Northwest Jobs and Guard Communications available. If you feel that coal is not a good thing, them that you will be provided with contacts for positions for social responsibility and Greenpeace, for example.
Can you tell us, for folks listening who want to know when and where?
Yes, the forum will take place tonight from 7 to 9:30 p.m. on the Concordia campus. We have a building known as the Hagen Center. It will be on the second floor, and there will be signage. This is an incredibly divisive topic around Portland. It's a topic that people care deeply about. Concordia has always been a very active member of the community, and this forum is just another way for us to take that active role and further it into the city of Portland itself. We're not here to promote one side or the other. We are just here to provide various points of view, and whichever way people want help in order to become an advocate for either side, we'd be more than happy to help them.
That was KBOO's Robin Ryan interviewing Akash Singh, an organizer of tonight's COAL Forum at Concordia University.
Too many Oregonians live paycheck to paycheck, according to a new report from the Corporation for Enterprise Development, or CFED. It suggests the state could expand some of its existing programs to increase more families' financial stability. With more, here is KBOO's Stephen Sherritt in cooperation with the Oregon News Service.
More than one-third of Oregon residents don't have enough money in savings to keep them afloat for 3 months, and the average family's credit card debt tops $10,000. Those are some of the findings in a new national report that makes recommendations about what states can do to help improve their financial stability. It suggests that Oregon keep and expand the state earned income tax credit for lowest wage workers. Nancy Yule, who leads Innovative Changes, a financial nonprofit in Portland, says the EITC's effects reach beyond the workers and into the community.
Financial instability impacts all of us. So an investment in opportunities for our working families, like the earned income tax credit, really is an investment in our state's economy and in our state's future.
The state EITC is scheduled to end this year if it isn't renewed in the Oregon legislature. It currently amounts to 6% of the federal EITC. The governor's budget recommends increasing it to 8%, but the report from the Nonprofit Corporation for Enterprise Development suggests expanding it to 18% of the federal amount. Oregon has a successful individual development account program that helps people save for specific goals from homeownership or college to a major home repair, and it matches their savings. A bill in the legislature would increase the amount of assets people are allowed to have and still qualify for the program. Rebecca Barger at NeighborWorks Umqua says a small retirement account is the only asset some people have, and expanding the IDA program makes sense for them.
We're stumbling upon situations more and more where people have money in a retirement account, but they can't access that account without a severe penalty, and it is excluding them from participating in the program.
The bill would allow a person with up to $60,000 in a retirement account to qualify for the Oregon IDA Savings Program as long as they meet the other income guidelines. With KBOO News, I'm Stephen Sherritt.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed at 6 by Tillicum Wawa, featuring Native American music, news, and other info pertinent to the Native American community. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will start out mostly cloudy with some patchy fog, but will gradually give way to mostly sunny skies with a high near 51 degrees. Tomorrow night will be partly cloudy with lows around 35 degrees.
It's just about coming up on 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Streeters are all a-Twitter about the comeuppance of Jamie Dimon, the haughty CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. Last year, poor Jamie presided over a $6 billion loss by the bank's chief investment office. So he's now had his own pay cut in half, knocking him down to $11.5 million. I suppose that's really a come-downance. But by whatever name, having his paycheck whacked by J.P. Morgan's board of directors is widely viewed on Wall Street as a harsh rap on the knuckles. But ask about the board's actions? Dimon himself merely said, "I respect their decision." Of course he does. He walked away with his job intact, an $11.5 million wad in his pocket, and a sly grin on his face. Indeed, many investors and bank regulators, not to mention us commoners, don't consider that level of, quote, punishment to be much of a deterrent to the kind of executive narcissism and carelessness that characterizes today's Wall Street elite. Yet, members of the bank's board are actually puffing out their chests, claiming to be bold bank directors. The vote to cut Diamond's pay, they say, shows that by gollies we're an effective take-charge watchdog over the top management of the nation's biggest bank. That they can even say something so absurd speaks volumes about the laissez-faire myth that corporations don't need government regulation since they have private boards that oversee them. Who are J.P. Morgan's directors? Lee Raymond, for one. In fact, he heads the board's compensation committee and took the lead in giving Diamond his haircut. But Raymond is congenitally gentle on CEO pay because he was a lavishly well-paid corporate chieftain himself. As CEO for ExxonMobil for 13 years, his paycheck totaled $686 million, $144,000 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, corporate governance is a joke.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Early this morning, a Texas activist disrupted a meeting of TransCanada and other oil pipeline construction companies. The activist chained himself to a podium and demanded that the company stop building the Keystone XL pipeline. The talk he interrupted was given by Tom Hamilton, manager of quality and compliance for TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline. The protester pointed out the irony of TransCanada lecturing others on safety and compliance, given their poor record of compliance themselves. The action took place at the PipeTech Americas Summit meeting, where delegates from various pipeline construction corporations discussed the newest advancements in pipeline technology and how to facilitate a close relationship with regulatory agencies. Here's a clip of the protester disrupting the meeting.
No, sir. Evan Volks, lead engineer, whistleblower, went to the NEB, caused massive audits, the results of which have yet to be released. Keystone XL will be a massive failure. Trevor Sands' blockade has proof positive that the welds are false. Can We've been inside the pipe, light shining through at mooring. With photographic and video evidence, their welds are inadequate. That pipe went into the ground
with great respect, sir.
An hour later.
With great respect, sir.
This is a...
Sorry, please. We understand that you're here to make your point. Your point has been made. You're black to our equipment. How do we get you off here?
I don't have a key.
That's a terrible cry and shame. Would you mind being quiet while he finishes his speech and we're going to get some bolt cutters here?
I don't believe that I can be quiet any longer. I will be idle no more, along with the indigenous residents of Canada who are standing up against tar sands extraction, which is toxifying at an extraordinary rate their communities, destroying their traditional lifeways through toxic tar sands extraction that the Keystone XL pipeline will only expand at a rate that will cause their culture to disintegrate like mine in the Gulf. I'm from Houma, Louisiana.
Anybody have some bolt cutters?
You can do all kinds of things, but it won't stop the grassroots resistance to Keystone XL.
Today's action to stop the Keystone XL pipeline comes just days after a court settlement was announced between TransCanada and protesters. That settlement banned direct action by Rising Tide North America and other groups, but did not prohibit individual action to try to prevent the construction of the largest tar sand pipeline in history from Canada all the way to the Texas coast.
A pair of consumer advocacy groups are criticizing Whole Foods and United Natural Foods Incorporated regarding labor violations. The International Labor Rights Forum has launched an investigation into the violations, which include threatening California workers who tried to form a union and firing warehouse workers in Auburn, Washington, who went on strike. Members of the bargaining team for Local 117 raised questions about the legality of maneuvering in the ongoing labor dispute for warehouse workers and drivers at the Auburn, Washington Distribution Center. Workers ended their strike after 2 days in December, citing over 40 violations of labor law. The company then told 72 employees, approximately half the group, that they had been permanently replaced. An investigation of those allegations remains underway by the National Labor Relations Board.
In Atlanta, Georgia, a middle school shooting has left a 14-year-old student seriously wounded. The boy, who's not yet been identified, was shot in the head outside of Price Middle School this afternoon. His wounds were not fatal. A spokesman with the Atlanta PD said that the teen was taken to a nearby hospital, quote, alert, conscious, and breathing, close quote. The police spokesman said that they believe the shooter, who's been taken into custody, is another student at the school. According to a local fire official, a teacher was also injured with cuts and bruises only and was treated immediately. Authorities have pointed out that all other students in the school are safe.
A man in Georgia was shot Saturday after pulling into the wrong driveway. 22-year-old Rodrigo Diaz and three friends rolled onto the elderly Philip Saylor's property Saturday evening. Upon finding the car in his driveway, Saylor reportedly pulled a gun from his house, shot in the air, and then shot Diaz in the head as the driver was attempting to leave. By Sunday morning, Diaz was dead. According to friends, Diaz had been following his GPS system to what he thought was another friend's house. Saylor's attorney says that his client feared a home invasion and fired in self-defense when Diaz's car moved towards him. Saylor and his wife had been wary after the recent robbery of a neighbor's home. Saylor was released Wednesday on a $10,000 bond.
As President Obama announced a bipartisan plan for immigration reform, a closer look at his plan shows a strong similarity to the so-called immigration reform pushed by George W. Bush in his second term. Both Bush and Obama's plans call for increased border security, for temporary guest worker programs, and for electronic verifying systems for employers. Matthew Denhart, a lead researcher at the conservative Bush Center, says the current proposal is virtually indistinguishable from George W. Bush's plan. Miguel Gabrielon Molina spoke this morning on Flashpoints about the reality of immigration policy under President Obama.
Under Obama's administration the last 4 years, there has been historical numbers of deportations, historical numbers of detention, and in reality, the re-fortification with the military of the U.S.-Mexican border. So never before in history has the border been tighter and more secure. So when they talk about more border security, what actually is that? Is this a way to stall the debate, to stall the, you know, reaching some kind of agreement and passing this thing through? A lot of it is play. A lot of it is play right now. You know, and one thing that people are asking, well, in this whole debate, you know, one of the groups, one of the largest groups, Dennis, unskilled and low-wage, you know, workers, undocumented workers, which are day laborers, farm workers, domestic workers, aren't even being brought into the conversation here. And one of the things that people are also asking is, hey, is this going to be an amnesty, you know, like it was 30 years ago? You know, they declared amnesty for all undocumented persons. It really isn't an amnesty. I mean, they're really going to look at this, and people are going, wait a second, is this going to allow, you know, the government to say, hey, we need now to dismantle ICE? Because remember, ICE came out of the INS, came out of the Patriot Act as a way to secure the borders, you know, and then it turned into, you know, hunting down, literally hunting down Mexicans, hunting down brown-skinned people, Latinos, and setting up record numbers of everything, you know. And this is the Obama's administration empowering, you know, Janet Napolitano, who just went crazy with this thing, you know, and enforcement. So, you know, is this going to be, are we going to see the end of ICE now? Is this part of the dialogue? If not, it needs to be, because ICE has turned into a mechanism, almost like a private army of the U.S. federal government, you know, to go after undocumented, basically, workers and families. So there's a lot of hope and sense, and people are saying there needs to be more dialogue. These issues need to be included. Is this going to end ICE? Is this going to be some kind of calling for a moratorium, you know, deportations and people being detained? At this point, none of that is happening.
That was Miguel Gabrielon Molina speaking this morning on Flashpoints.
This afternoon, U.S. officials announced that the National Intelligence Council is preparing a new national intelligence estimate in response to the cyber attacks on both the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. According to the Associated Press, U.S. officials said the NIE would highlight the cyber threat as a looming economic problem, outlining the administration's concerns in regards to the threat and possible avenues for more aggressive actions against cyber espionage. The assessment will also shed light on the role of the Chinese government in recent cyber espionage. The Obama administration is seeking a more assertive approach to cyber espionage dialogues with the Chinese government, the primary suspect in the cyber attacks against the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, along with Chinese hackers. Chinese foreign and defense ministries deny any involvement in cyber espionage.
Dwindling bee colonies in Europe may be getting some relief. Today, the European Union Commissioner for Health and Consumer Policy, Tonio Borg, proposed a ban on the use of three pesticides on crops that commonly attract bees. The rapid decline of bee colonies has harmed agriculture in both Europe and North America over the last decade. Bees pollinate a wide variety of plants and commercial crops, including those that produce such things as carrots, avocados, blueberries. Since last March, multiple studies have linked pesticides to an 85% drop in the number of queen bees produced by colonies. Several advocacy groups have blamed the United Kingdom and Germany for delaying a ban on pesticides, but they applaud the European Union for finally recognizing the role of pesticides in this crisis. The European Union will vote on the proposed ban in late February.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for Thursday, January 31st, 2013. Palestinian family killed in Gaza by a fire in their house, and UN fact-finding mission on Israeli settlements published its report. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian family of six was killed today in Gaza City after their house caught fire on the early dawn hours. The Palestinian police in Gaza said that the family was using candles to light their house